For the last 3 days, we have been feting Professor Veldman and trying to pay him the honor that we all feel for what he has accomplished over the course of his career and what has just been recognized with the award of the Nobel Prize. Today is really the best part of his visit. And by the way, we are especially indebted to him for coming back to the University of Michigan so quickly after having been awarded the Nobel Prize. Tini said that it was odd being in his house in Holland, utterly anonymous on one day and having the world at his doorstep the next. And within 5 days, he's back in Ann Arbor. And for that, we are very, very grateful. I want to make sure that we mark especially the creativity that is involved in Professor Veltman's career, because that is really what all of us aspire to have and enjoy in the academic community, whether it's as a faculty member or as a student. And that moment of creativity that that Professor Veltman has spoken about in the last couple of days so powerfully is also undergirded by many, many years and hours of work, of thinking about things over and over and over again, late into the night, into the early morning, weekends. The part of being an intellectual is never being able to give up the process of thinking about something that has grabbed your attention. On the other hand, at the dinner at the house last night in Professor Veltman's honor, I commented, and I'm going to repeat myself, on how recipients of Nobel Prizes frequently say things that the rest of us follow unduly. One of the things that Nobel Prize winners are inclined to say in response to "When did you first discover this?" it's typical for them to say things like, "It was in a parking lot outside a grocery store. As I sat there, suddenly it occurred to me." I personally have sat in many parking lots many, many years and never had that experience, though I'm still trying. The Department of Physics is proud of this great award, and justly so. Many people at this university over the past 2 decades share in this great accomplishment of Professor, or great honor for the university that Professor Veltman has brought upon us. Ed Yao last night said that at their table, it occurred to them because of Professor Veltman's humor and partly because of the substance of his work, that they're sure that Einstein said, "God does not play dice with nature, but Tini will flip the coin." We should be treated to some of that humor today, but the main thing I want to say to you is, on behalf of the university, not only the current faculty and the current students, but on behalf of the university for the time that you've spent here for 16 years, congratulations to you, and thank you for being part of the University of Michigan. Stir up.
Thank you, President Bollinger, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this special public lecture honoring our colleague, Professor Martinus Veltman, the winner of the 1999 Nobel Prize in Physics. Yes. Winning the Nobel Prize is above all a great personal achievement, reflecting upon the marvelous research career of Professor Veltman. It is also a source of great joy for all of us in the physics department. It attests to the fact that the College of Literature, Sciences and Arts supports outstanding science programs, and it heralds that this institution, the University of Michigan, is a major player and that research and intellectual inquiry here have a very bright future. Professor Weltmann, Tini, as he is known to all of us, is a man of immense intellectual vigor, strong will, integrity, and honesty. Tini was born on June 27, 1931, in the Netherlands. He received his master's degree in theoretical physics from the University of Utrecht in 1956 and completed his PhD from the same institution in 1963. In the years between 1961 and 1966, he was a staff member at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland. In 1966, he was appointed professor of physics at his alma mater, University of Utrecht. In 1980, Tini accepted an invitation to come to Michigan as a visiting professor. While here in Ann Arbor, my colleagues, and especially then chair of the department, Professor Dick Sands, worked hard to convince Tini and his wife Aniki to stay at Michigan. The arm twisting eventually worked. Professor Weltmann accepted our offer and became the MacArthur Professor of Physics in 1981. The 16 years Professor Weltmann spent here as a regular faculty were years of great scientific productivity and intense teaching and training of graduate students and postdocs. He has been a leading figure in the world of physics, and we all benefited immensely from having him as our colleague. In 1997, Tini retired as Professor Emeritus and returned to Holland. The list of Professor Weltmann's awards, honors, and memberships on the distinguished scientific panels and learned societies is simply too long to cite here. I will only note his Senior Humboldt Award in 1989, honorary doctorate from the University of New York at Stony Brook received in 1989, High Energy Physics Prize for 1993 awarded by the European Physical Society, and the fact that in 1992 he was knighted into the Dutch Order of the Lion by Queen Beatrix. The crowning achievement of his distinguished career is his work done jointly with his student Gerardus Tuft, in which they showed how to solve the difficulties encountered in theories of weak interactions. For his decisive scientific contributions, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has awarded the 1999 Nobel Prize for Physics jointly to Professors Weltmann and Tuft. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Weltmann, who will deliver the lecture entitled Understanding Particles. Professor Weltmann.
I have a bit of a problem, which I'll try to explain to you first before we go into the details of the lecture I want to give. The problem is I really have, for this one lecture, really had a hard time of preparing it. Normally when I do a lecture, I start thinking about it real long ago. It forms in my head, and then one day, 1 hour, I sit down and I write the whole thing. But this, I hadn't done that, of course, before I got this prize. I really had no inkling I would be standing here at this time. Even if I might have been thinking about a Nobel Prize, I didn't think of its consequences, so you understand what I'm saying. So it's not prepared to my satisfaction, but I'll do my best, and I ask you for a certain amount of clemency in delivering this. Now, secondly, I have to answer finally, and he asked for it because it's the second time I hear it, this matter of the parking lot. I hesitate to say where I had my ideas. I would hate it to see Professor Bollinger tramping in my bathroom at all times of the day. So be careful with that joke, it might backfire. Okay, so what I'm going to try to do is to give you a feeling as to what has been going on. People don't know in general that much about elementary particle physics, and I want at least, there's no hope that I can explain to you the details of quantum mechanics because that's very difficult. But we have in particle physics a way of dealing with quantum mechanics, which is through Feynman diagrams, which a little bit of talk I can coax you in believing that you understand it. Yeah. So that's what I'm going to do. And I will do that somewhat along the lines that I got introduced to it myself. So let me start off with the first slide. That's here. Maybe you can dim the lights a bit. Now, what is this? This is Geneva that's here in this corner, Geneva. I hope you see the light here. And this here is the airport of Geneva. I have a picture of my wife coming there with our first child, and she looked cheerful, not knowing what was coming up. And here, there's a road from Geneva to CERN. That's where I started in 61. CERN is an abbreviation for European Nuclear Research. It's not nuclear research, it's elementary particle research. It had an accelerator, which is a tiny circle that you can see here. Yeah, somewhere here. Don't know exactly where, actually. And this is the frontier between Switzerland and France. And so this sets the scale. That's where all the airplanes come up and down. And this is more or less where we lived. So we lived very near to the airplanes. And I don't know why people complain about the airplanes. I never noticed them, really. And so this is the latest accelerator that has been built. This is drawn. Huh? This is not a real thing. The accelerator itself is something below the ground. It's underground, quite deep. Yeah. So we started off with a little accelerator there in 1961, and gradually it became this one here. And I'm going to follow that route from, so you could say, let's try to trace what happened going from there to there. And the last thing I will say in this lecture will be about what happened using that machine. Okay. Now the next slide will show you what you see underground. This is in that first thing. This was what called that machine that we had at that time. You see a series of magnets which are around a pipe. Yeah. And in that pipe, the particles, the protons, that are hydrogen atoms of which you strip the electron away, which you can do by having a strong electric discharge in hydrogen. So these protons going around here, the magnet keeps them in orbit, bends them so that they remain in the pipe. And then at every station here there's a big voltage going, is set so that every time the particle passes here, it gets a kick. And it goes around many times, these particles, and eventually they get to be to very high energy. The magnets go up in strength, a little bit in the beginning, but as the particle goes faster and faster and faster, these magnets increase in strength so that the particles are kept within orbit. So this is the machine that is underground in that circle that you saw drawn here. Okay, this is the circle, a rather small one. This was one the machine initially had a diameter of 200 meters, which is a bit over 200 yards. I cannot translate in these measures, yeah, but I'll make an effort. And so you get an idea what it is. You can see the bending it. And it was fun to walk along it and see what's going on and feel these protons racing, you know, Anyway, let's see the next one. That's the tunnel that we have today. And you can see that this thing has become much bigger. It's almost straight. And one of the major problems one has with these machines today is that if something happens somewhere, the thing has a diameter or a circumference which is about 30 kilometers, a bit less than 17 miles. Yeah. And now you imagine something breaks down at mile 15. You need half an hour to get there. Yeah. So that these things are real problems that these people have to face. I remember once a long discussion if you had to put a bicycle there or a motorcycle or what have you. Yeah. Okay, this gives you an idea of what's underground, and there you can see that these particles get accelerated and they come to very, very high energy, and what happens then? The next thing that happens The next thing that happens is that you collide such a particle with another particle, with the target. So you shoot the particle that you have accelerated to tremendous energy onto a particle which is sitting there not knowing what's going to happen to him. And then these two come together, and what you do is you create a ball of energy. I want you to understand it that way. You have a ball of energy. Yeah. So here is what happens here. You have a ball of energy coming up there. Yeah. And so there's the particle at left that essentially is at rest. I drew it in a symmetric way for reasons that you will become clear to you later on. And they collide, and then you get a ball of energy. And what happens in nature when you have a ball of energy? Well, it will disintegrate. In every time it will disintegrate in different ways. Generally, it will disintegrate in whatever is possible. If something is possible, you wait long enough, that's how it will go. So you get all kinds of stuff going out there, all kinds of particles. And for the first time, you get to see the particles you didn't know that existed beforehand. And these are particles which are unstable. The known stable elementary particles are very simple, and they are in daily use, you might say, light. Photons are elementary particles. There's lots of them around all the time, and you can study a lot from elementary particles studying the behavior of photons. There are electrons that power so much of what we see around us. Yeah? And so these electrons move through wire. They are the other elementary particle that is of daily around us. And then there's the nucleus and the nuclei and the protons there. The protons are not elementary particles because they are made of still smaller things called quarks. Those we think today are elementary. And we have some reason to believe that's what they will be forever, but you can never be sure. So those are the elementary particles. And whenever you make a collision, well, the elementary particles, in addition, you then have particles that are simply bound state, and the proton is the best example. But there are many others. Quarks bind in all possible bewildering ways. It's really incredible. And before we understood quarks, understanding elementary particles, understanding all these bound states you got, and it was very confusing and took quite a while and some real piece of genius, mainly from Mr. Gell-Mann from Caltech, to understand how these things were hanging together, but now we think we understand. But there are many particles which are bound states of quarks and which have the habit of being unstable. And so here enters a new concept that you probably didn't know. When you have such a collision, there are many particles coming out, sort of everything you can think up with a certain probability, and then they live for a little while and decay. So for the first time, you get to see particles that you don't see around in daily life because they decay very quickly, like in 1 millionth of a second or even much shorter. In fact, the unstable particle which is longest lived is the neutron, which lives like 15 minutes or something. So you produce a lot of particles. So in those accelerators is, in a sense, a God-given thing. You can produce everything by just colliding with sufficiently high energy. You can make only those things that have a mass which is not too high, because we have learned from Einstein that mass is energy, and that energy is conserved. And the maximum you can make is putting all the energy that was in the collision in the mass of some particle, but not more. So if you have that goes in a certain measure, which I'll call for you the MEV or the GEV, and never mind what it is, but at CERN, at that machine over there, we had some 30 GEV of energy, and for all kinds of reasons that limited the particles that you could create to those which has a mass, which had a mass of, let's say, 2, 3 GEV, or maybe a bit more. And 2, 3 GEV is about 3 times as much as the proton. So in that machine at CERN and a similar machine in Brookhaven here in the US, one created new particles and could study them, see them, and now how does that go? How do you see them? So this is the first thing, the making of the thing. Now, once you have made it, you can go get at it. One thing you do in this fireball that you make them, you say, I want to study pions. Never mind what pions are. Pions is some kind of particle that decays and lives only a short time, something like, what is it, 10 to the minus 10 or something seconds, or less even. In any case, it lives a short time, but long enough to go some distance, because they come out with high velocity, and you can study them. And the way that's done in these machines is generally you produce there everything, and then you make some apparatus that filters. that let pass through only certain kinds of particles, particles who have discharge, whatever have you, yeah? And in this way, you can create beams of only one kind of particles. And see, by this technique, you then come into an area of experimentation that you couldn't have dreamt of before. At once, you can make beams of particles that don't normally not even exist in nature. You make them. And then you quickly do your experiment before they decay or you have nothing anymore in your hands. And so one way of doing it, I'll sketch you now the first experiment that I, in my ignorance at the time, was really had the privilege of sitting on the side of it. It's called the CERN 1963 neutrino experiment. It was for the first time by this kind of technique neutrinos were created. And this was a wonderful experiment. And it sort of set the tone for most of my professional life. And it is a thing I will never forget because it impressed me so much. Here's that machine, of which I have drawn here only a piece. Then you had a target, that's the particles coming out of the machine were collided with the particles here. And a lot of stuff was coming out, like I've shown you. That here you would have the fireball, and here would the stuff be coming out. Yeah. And then here there was a great big invention of another Dutch man, Mr. Simon van der Meer, an engineer. It was a piece of genius that he's really a great man. Actually, he got the Nobel Prize in 1984 for other work. Yeah. He made what was called the horn, the magnetic horn, or the horn of plenty. What it did was focusing the particles to go in the forward direction. So in this way, the particles that were created were all sort of bent in the forward direction. So that's there, so all they go. And there were many pions. You may not know much about pions, but let me tell you, pions do disintegrate rather quickly after they've been made. You let them go a little while, then they disintegrate. And then when you look to the decay products, the things that you find after the particle decays, there's a lot of neutrinos. And so here, as these particles are moving along, all these pions would be decaying, and gradually you got here lots of neutrinos going. And then there was here an awful mass of iron. We're talking about something like 50 yards of iron, solid iron. In a similar experiment at Brookhaven, they used a whole battleship, if I'm not mistaken. And then behind that iron then, no particle can make it through all that iron except the neutrinos, because neutrinos are at that time certainly very badly understood particles, but the main thing they did was doing nothing. Yeah. They collided so rarely that even in sending them through the Earth, the probability of them doing anything on the way was practically nil. And so to get to a state of affairs where you got enough neutrinos coming here so that you could actually detect them, that you had some chance of seeing them, required an intensity and a machinery, etc., which happened to be possible. Yeah. Those first experiments were in 1963, and then behind it you had detection instruments, and now I must tell you what the detection instruments are. You must, if you want to study elementary particle, have an instrument whereby you can see that particle, or at least see what it does. For this, there were, in those days, mainly two types of instruments. And one of them was called the bubble chamber. And the other one was called the spark chamber. I'll explain to you roughly how they work. If I get the next slide. You see here the empty shell of what used to be a very famous bubble chamber called Gargamel. Gargamel is a figure out of the French literature. The guy who ate so much that I think I would be small respect to him. So here you have Gargamel, big thing. Here you see a bicycle to get the magnitudes, yeah, more or less set. There's lots of holes in here. That thing was filled up with a liquid, which was operated around its boiling point. I'll not go in technical details. But when a particle would go through there, that particle would hit the various molecules inside that bubble chamber. And then, as a consequence, little bubbles would follow around that track. So particles would create tracks in such a bubble chamber. And of those, you would make pictures with cameras you put in the side here. And that's the way you would observe those particles. And then usually one would put a magnet around that bubble chamber. You can imagine the kind of magnet you have around here, so that you had a magnetic field in the bubble chamber. And if you have an electrically charged particle moving in that magnetic field, it will bend this way if it's negative, that way if it's positively charged. Those were the bubble chambers that one used. The next picture shows you, the next slide shows you the kind of picture you got from those. Yeah. Here you see a particle coming in. It collides with something in that fluid there, and you get lots of secondary particles coming out. I just show you this particle to give you an idea as to what happens. Other particles come in and move on without doing anything, or here you have one coming on and do only very little, and this one did a lot. And so that's the way you observe what particles are doing. And you stand them for the task of identifying what's going on here. You might say they look all the same. That's because you're ignorant. So let's see to the next slide. Here you see how bad it can be. And this is still nothing compared to what's to come later on. So here you have such a bunch of particles that any sane human being would not possibly look at it longer than a second. Now, I think I want one more picture that shows you a bit more simplicity, and it shows you something else that I will want to get to. In any case, here you see such a reaction, and you see these trucks here, huh? These ones here. Quickly curve. They curve because there's a magnetic field. And these trucks, any expert recognizes immediately as being electrons or positrons. Positrons are as electrons, but with the opposite charge. And the reason they curve is because, of course, the magnetic field. But they lose these electrons when moving through that material. They lose their energy. They slow down, and they start doing precisely this. Yeah, as you see, they wind down. Yeah. So here you see lots of electrons. Then you see other particles, and I am now going to show you another. Thank you. I now... let me also show you how spark chambers act. Yes. May I have the next slide? The spark chamber is a wonderful instrument. Something happens with the microphone, I believe. The spark chamber is a wonderful instrument which does the following. Is the microphone down or something? Yeah, you hear anything? Good for you. Okay. Now here is a spark chamber, and what happens is this. You see here lots of iron plates, yeah? Many of them. Now what happens is, between those plates there is some gas, and then when a particle passes through like this, it knocks some electrons off the atoms in the gas, and thereby ionizes them. That's what you call ionization, if you knock an electron off an atom. And then when you put a high tension between the plates, a spark will go at precisely those plates as places because electricity goes easier there. Yeah? So you produce a spark. And so then you get a series of sparks and you see the track of the elementary particle. Now here you see a reaction, therefore you see one coming in. It's not such a nice instrument as the bubble chamber. You see less detail, where you see here one particle going a long way, and every expert in the business will tell you this is a muon, because only muons can go such a long distance between through so much material. Yeah? The only charged particle that can do that. There are other particles over here, and it's not that easy to see what's going on there. And besides, with these spark chambers, it's hard to have a magnetic field. So you cannot see, they don't curve, and you cannot see what that charge is. In any case, that's another type of detection instrument. And the importance of this detection instrument is that you can put a lot of material in it, which for neutrino experiments is very important. Let's look at the next slide. That's just another example of a spark chamber. Oh, somebody screwed up. Me. Back, please. This is... I'm sorry about that. Someone... Well, you're going to get the next slides in... Not no next slide. You're going to get them in random order, so... So, but we don't need them for a little while to come. I'll now show you, gradually I'm now going on to the... I'll show you another picture of a bubble chamber, which is sort of neat. It's one of my favorites. It was produced in this CERN neutrino experiment. And we all wanted to know what was going on. What's going on here? There was a neutrino coming. It produced a muon that didn't do anything, just follow its way there. And then what happened here? Many electrons, positrons, and what was going on? And here's the recoiling nucleus of the thing that was hit,
lots of, that's what it is. And what's going on here? And this was one of the mysteries. That event became so famous, one person started devoting almost her entire life and time to it. So much so, we started calling it after that person. This event is generally known among us as the Agnès event. You wanted to know something about it, you went to Agnès. But since she didn't know what happened either, so in the end, it didn't help. Now, I will come back to this one here, because now, slowly, it's time you get into the world of particles in a real way. So now I'm going to look to interactions among elementary particles. What do they do? Now, there are at least three particles that you know of very well, without perhaps realizing it. There's the electron, which I call E minus. It has an electric charge, with all the consequences due to that. Then there's the photon, that's what light is. So there's lots of photons going from this apparatus and bombarding there the screen. And then there's the graviton, which you don't know, but that's what we think is an elementary particle that is responsible for the forces of gravitation. So these are particles that are around us in multitude all the time, and offered us in the past great opportunity to study precisely the laws of motion of elementary particles. Those laws of motion were studied intensively in the beginning of this century, well, let's say up till 1930, 40, and that resulted in the science of quantum mechanics. It's a very difficult subject. You need really a substantial amount of mathematics to do it, but let's say it's just that part of mechanics that allows you to compute what electrons, photons, particles in general, elementary particles in general, what they do when they collide, when they move, how that goes, the laws governing their motion. So that's quantum mechanics, and that came into being before World War II, and it was only really sort of during after World War II that the next step was taken and we got all the other elementary particles coming up, gradually, one by one. Now, we want to start playing with those elementary particles, and the first thing we do is make a picture. Yeah. And that picture is a picture of what an electron can do with a photon. Now, what can it do with a photon? For sure, it can do something, because what do you think happens inside this light bulb here that's emitting all those photons? What happens is that there are electrons there which make a kick, whatever, but these electrons then emit the photons. That's the basic process that can happen. You can see it in various ways in daily life, emitting light. All that light that you see here comes from electrons moving, colliding, what have you, and then in the process sending out photons. So all the photons you see here are coming somehow from the electrons down there in the light bulb. And I've indicated that by means of this drawing. You see an electron moving, and at some point it loses a photon, so to say. This is a basic process, the fact that an electron can emit a photon. I want to do that on a separate slide in the corner somewhere, except, hey, what's going on here? What happened to my machine? There was another projector here, supposed to project on here. Well, we have to abandon the hope here. That's too bad. What happened to that projector here? Ah, you were trying to steal it. See, I wanted to use that projector to gradually build up what we are studying. Well, now we got another problem. I told you this lecture is sort of badly prepared, and that's mainly my fault, but it's also your fault. I want to make a picture here, if we can make it go. On that screen. Okay. So here, gradually, we will see this this stuff building up. And we start off with the electron emitting a photon, which is a thing that ought to be known to you since it happens all the time. Whenever you look, here goes the electron, and it may emit a photon, which I will make blue. This is a basic process, and it is on the basis of everything as far as if it comes to emission of light. But of course, light wouldn't be very meaningful or very useful if you also could not see it. So the opposite process has to happen also. That is typically what happens in your eye. A photon comes in, hits an electron, and the electron moves on, but it changes its states, and somehow eventually that results in a picture in your brain. So we can also have this process. The photon comes in and hits an electron, and there the electron goes on and does whatever it does that makes us see things. So we now see these two possibilities. And from this,
in a
sweeping step, I'm sorry. I think, Mr. Bollinger, some people ought to be fired here. I remember once I was walking with the Director General of CERN to the terrace, and it was full. I said, fire two of them, but he never did. People are too kind, yeah, but anyway, I'm sure it's just... Here now I want you to teach you something, which of course I know is true, but now you must learn it from me. Whenever you have some process going, you get another possibility, another thing that may happen, just by bending those lines from coming in to going out. In other words, look at this one. This really differs only here from the fact that the photon that came out now becomes an incoming photon. Yeah. So all I do is sort of bending that thing back. And that, if you wish to go along with me in stating that that is a general principle, which it is, then we generate a very interesting other possibility. And the possibility being that the photon, I'm now going to bend somebody else. I'm going to bend that electron. So what about this thing here? Now I pulled that line like this. Is this a possible thing? Well, let's first think a bit before we put this to the test. This was an electron negatively charged. And there's a photon, which we generally indicate by that symbol gamma. And the electron has a negative charge, and nature is always very careful with electric charge. It doesn't change. You do not make ever any extra, nor does it go away. So it is conserved, as we put it. Now here you start with zero electric charge. We wind up with an electron. That was the one that we had already. Now what about this one? Since the photon has no electric charge, the sum of these two charges must be zero, because nature doesn't make charge. It always remains the same. For this reason, I know that this animal has to be something which has a positive electric charge, so that together they are neutral. So this animal, I will then call, it will be much like the electron, except it has the opposite charge. I will call that a positron. And, of course, the beauty of this idea is that nature seems to do so. This thing has been discovered, and actually, I show you this process. I can show it to you. It was on this transparency. Here you have it. Here you have a photon. Goes this way, up to here, this point. Yeah. Let me point it up here. Here, this point. Here goes a photon. At this point, it creates an electron and a positron, a pair. And you see it happening all over the place. So at once you see how these seagulls come about. These seagulls are in fact photons that convert into an electron-positron pair. So here you see experimental proof of the diagram that I have drawn here. And the technique that I have now developed of working with these diagrams shows you one step. Because there's more to it. You have to bend everybody and study it more detailed and how it depends on the energy of those particles, etc. but we are not going to worry about those details. I just want you to believe at this point this principle. Once I have some basic process, I get other processes just by bending things around. And so that's very interesting, and we may learn a lot from it. So now we have gotten a new process. It's called pair creation. Yeah, that was on this transparency. And I can tell you at this point that we now are getting familiar with what us physicists call Feynman diagrams. These things are Feynman diagrams, or other parts. Well, they are Feynman diagrams. You may build them out, as I will do shortly. They are named after Mr. Feynman from Caltech, who came up with this idea. And what the idea by itself is nice, to put it like this, but what makes them useful to us particle physicists is that we know exactly what kind of quantities correspond to that. And the reason we know that is this. We know perfectly well to what extent an electron can radiate a photon and how much and under what circumstances. These are things we know very, very well. For instance, if you have in an antenna electrons moving about and they send out radio waves, that's one such process. And we know that perfectly. They are described by Maxwell's laws. So we know precisely in terms of numbers what's going on there. And in Feynman rules, it's like this. You draw a picture like this, and then with your left hand, so to say, with your right hand, you immediately write down whatever expression, whatever thing corresponds to it that makes it quantitative and precise. So it's not just you draw a picture of what's going on. We have a very minute, precise mathematical equation that corresponds to the probability of this happening. So we have the thing under control. And at the same time, all these other processes sort of follow from that. So the beauty of the Feynman diagrams is they are intuitively sort of nice to understand. And then for us, if we want to go down to the nitty-gritty, we can do it. We have the precise equations for that. So remember that, although of course I will not go into that because I'm not going to make any equations today. But remember, they are there. They are lurking in the background. And we can do it with numbers into any number of decimals. So those are the Feynman diagrams. Now there are other processes. The beauty of Feynman diagrams is that you can build up processes. For example, here in this process you have an electron. It emits a photon that hits another electron and then it goes on this way. So this is an exchange of a photon between two electrons. And to the outside world it appears like two electrons collide because that photon that you exchanged you will, of course, not see. It remains hidden. So what you see is two electrons doing this, a simple scattering. And since we know exactly numerically what's going on, we can compute that. And indeed, you can compute using those Feynman diagrams and the rules that we have with them. You can compute in precise detail how this scattering process goes about. This is what you would call Coulomb scattering, and you can compare it, of course, with what you see in the laboratory. And I would say this is the first example of how, given Feynman rules, you can have more and more complex processes where eventually you can start with one particle, get two, and then that can make more. So you can see that using these rules, you can get into a situation where you start with two particles and wind up with 500. There's all kinds of twists to it. So those are the Feynman rules, which are the daily life of all of us particle physicists. And we know, armed with this insight, of course, by now you understand these things perfectly. Yeah? You can do it. If you only had the time to study the equation, you could do those as well. And so now we go to another domain, and that's to that neutrino experiment, which I was just talking to you about. So neutrinos coming into these detection instruments and doing things, and what are they doing? And I should tell you that one of the first processes ever discovered was the one by Becquerel in the previous century. Imagine in another half year, I will have to say two centuries ago. So that's the end of the 1800s. Mr. Becquerel discovered beta decay, as we call it, which is decay of a neutron that goes into a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino. So it decays into three particles, where one of them is very hard to see because it has no charge and does so little. The electron you can always see, it has a charge, it shakes off photons, it collides with other electrons and so on. and the proton is also easy to see in bubble chamber pictures and what have you. So this is neutron decay. And now, question, can this neutrino that we have here, can it also function? Could I have a process that comes, that I would get, and that would be from this one, can be obtained from this one by bending one of the lines? So I go back in gear. I know this one exists. Therefore, I guess if Mr. Feynman had any right in allowing us to bend particles in or out, I would think that this process is also possible. And I also remember that the electron, which was a negatively charged particle, when I bend that one around, it becomes a positron. And we will call that the antiparticle. So when you bend things around, a particle becomes an antiparticle and the other way around. And a thing like a photon, you can bend around because it's sort of its own antiparticle, so you don't have to bother about that one. And the antineutrino becomes a neutrino, and that's why I've drawn it this way, and that's actually the way we do it. So I think from the discovery of Mr. Becquerel, combined with the insight that I've got here, we now must have the possibility of this process, a neutrino hitting a neutron, making an electron and a proton. And this is precisely what was observed in those experiments at CERN, and we know we're on the right track. There are complications that I don't want to go into. Instead of an electron, we actually saw a muon, etc., other particles. But that would break up the rhythm of this discussion, so I'm not going into it. There is something pretty bad about that process that you cannot know, and that you will have to take onto face value from me. And that is, this process is to us bad. And the badness is this. You can compute it, yeah? You can, if you write a thing like that down, since we knew all about beta decay from Mr. Becquerel, we could from there compute what the other would do, the other process. And when you do that calculation, you find that this process will be depending on the energy of the neutrino. And then you discover very quickly that this reaction, the probability of this happening, increases strongly with the energy of the neutrino, to be precise, with the square of the neutrino energy. And in other words, as the neutrino is from higher and higher energy, the probability of this reaction happening becomes arbitrarily big, goes to infinity. And this we cannot have for a number of reasons. Reason number one is there are very high energy neutrinos in cosmic rays, and we would have seen them. If they were really so violently reacting according to that equation, they would do something. They would make collisions. You would see them. So neutrinos of high energy would become highly visible if they were so strongly interacting. That's point number one. Yeah. And point number two is that there is a theoretical thing that I won't go into. It has to do with rescattering in quantum mechanics. You can always have that the outgoing particles recombine and do something again. And then when you compute such things, you find infinity, and these are the infinities of field theory that us people have been plagued with for a very long time and didn't know to handle. And that's very much associated with the kind of work that I was trying to do in the 70s. So this kind of behavior, a process that explodes as a function of energy, goes up like this, anything that goes up simply brings you into trouble sooner or later. You don't have to know precisely where, but let me put it to you like this. This is the key thing. You have a process like that. It grows. It becomes, the probability of it happening increases as a function of energy. We are in trouble. So how do we cure it? As a theoretician, you set out, can I do something about this process here that makes it tamer, makes it better? There is something you can do about it. And what you can do about it, if I make the analogon, I know processes that are quite innocent, quite harmless, that look a lot like it. It's this one I just talked about. It's electron scattering of each other. Now, this was well known and studied. This is Coulomb scattering. They did that for as long as they know electrons. Scatter them off each other and see what happens. And so there's nothing wrong with that scattering process. It doesn't go up with the energy square either. It's fine. Now, so if you study this process as a function of the energy of these electrons, no problem at all. So what do we do? Well, that's the big thing that you have to learn when you do science. You have to be sufficiently stupid. If you run up into a wall, just do what you did yesterday. Yeah. That's like predicting weather. just predict the weather for tomorrow what you have today. You have 70% probability in Holland, here it must be 90, that this is correct. Which is already something. So what you do is you invent a particle and you put it in between, as was the photon. So here we start doing something new. We start inventing particles in order to make life better, in order to make things behave better. So here we have the neutrino. We take this process and put something in between. And we give it whatever property is needed to make it go in the correct manner, which in this case means we have to give it a charge, you see, because this neutrino is neutral. The electron has a negative charge. So I better give this thing a positive charge, or else I would not have conservation of charge, and this we cannot have. So it has to be a thing which I will call a vector boson, and that goes in between here, and would that do the trick? And it indeed does the trick, just as it did in the photon case, and you get something that behaves in this manner, and everybody is happy. Yeah. So by the introduction of a vector boson, you can make at least this process behave in a manner that one can live with. And this was a state of affair of elementary particle physics roughly when I entered the business. And that neutrino experiment that we had at CERN had as main goal see if we could find some more evidence for this vector boson. And we would have found the evidence if the thing had not been too heavy. We would have found evidence if the thing had not been more heavy than 3 times heavier the proton. But today we know it's like 90 times heavier than the proton, so we didn't stand a chance, you know. We didn't know that, of course, but looking back you think, well. But we were looking at those pictures, and that was a very exciting time. You saw these pictures coming, you sort of see, is it there, is it there, is it there? You would see little things that would indicate it was there. And the Agnes event would be typically something that you would expect from such an event. I would have to tell you more about it, but believe me, it does. So this was the vector boson. And so far, so good. We didn't discover it, but most of us thought it would be there, except we didn't know how heavy it was and we couldn't get a handle on it, and that was the state of affairs of experiment. So, oh no. I'm always scared that I'm losing pages. Yeah. Now, what next? Now we go look. Here is where the trouble starts. So now I start to do theory beyond the 60s, so to say. I'm moving on to the end of the 60s. I start inventing processes in my mind with these particles that I have been putting in there and see if nothing funny is going to happen, something that I could not live with. And there's another process again between electrons and photons that's well known and that you can understand. You could have an electron colliding with a photon collides with an electron, and then a little bit later the electron shakes the photon off again. This is even to you known in some modified form. It's not literally the same, but something vaguely like it is with stuff that you shine light off and you turn the light off and later on you see light coming off. It's not a good comparison. But this is, think of it sort of in that way. Huh? So this process can happen. It's known. It's called Compton scattering. And now Compton scattering has this Feynman diagram. You can again compute what the probability is for this happening as a function of the energy of the photon. And what you find is that this one is bad, real bad. But what is the saving grace? We know from experiment that there's nothing funny going on, so it couldn't really be bad. But the fact is, you realize by bending lines, I can get another possibility. This is this diagram. Yeah? And if Mr. Feynman was right by allowing me to bend lines, this should also be a possible diagram. There's a second possibility of an electron scattering of an electron, of a photon. So here, in this case, first the electron shakes off a photon, then gets on the photon coming in and becomes an electron again. A slightly different reaction, and when you compute it, you get a slightly different expression. And now here comes something, a new element in the discussion. It's the element of interference of quantum mechanics. It is the fact that particles, in a rough manner, behave like waves. And that means to us, I don't want to make your life more complicated than it is, it means that things can interfere and damp out or amplify. Waves can do that too, you know that. So you can have two waves in a point and they can damp each other out. Yeah? Or they can amplify. As a matter of fact, when they damp out here, usually they have to amplify here because it has to go somewhere. Now, with particles that can too, you can have two different processes. and they can amplify each other or they can damp each other. Yeah. And the fact is, when you compute these things, you discover that they damp each other, so that together everything is fine. Individually, they are terribly bad, you can't live with them, but together they work. And so you see here a new phenomenon, and it is that different possibilities cooperate to make life okay. Now, armed with this example, everything that contains only electrons and photons was well known to physicists before World War II, so that was a solid body of knowledge to work on. But now we go over back again to our vector bosons, because now I want to see what goes on with my vector bosons. I can do similar things with them as with this, with the electron and the photon. So you get something like this. You have an electron coming here, there's the vector boson, it becomes a neutrino, then it spits out the vector boson, becomes an electron. All I'm using here is the same basic thing that I should have drawn. Well, let me not... Maybe I should... Here's a new type of diagram that we are having. I was just making it. When I inserted that vector boson there, I created two new, what we might call, vertices. You can have an electron becoming a neutrino while having a vector boson. You remember this one here? That was on the top of the other diagram. You can also have it with a proton, but I don't need that, so here this is a vector boson. That's an electron, that's a neutrino. And so this is a basic thing that I can have, and therefore you can see in that diagram up above, I use only that as a building block. Yeah. And so this is a possible reaction. And now I compute what happens to this reaction, the probability. I use the equation. I discovered just in the previous case, it goes bad when you go to high energies. Then I say to myself, well, for sure, but we will also have then the other possibility. And here comes the funny thing, I cannot. The other possibility would be this diagram. Here is W again, and here the electron. But now look at it, what conservation of electric charge forces me to. Here the W combines with the electron to make a neutral particle. There's the positive W, the negative electron is a neutral particle. Now here the electron has to emit a positively charged particle. Therefore, what I must have here is a particle with double negative charge. And you know what? They don't exist. So this is not a real possibility. If nature had given me doubly negative particles, then you might say we're getting somewhere, except what you realize at this point, if there exists such a doubly negative particle, I'm going to dream up a process where I start with this double negative one and get a triple negative one. And so gradually, I get onto the famous creek without a pedal. Yeah? So I can't really work with this. So what are we going to do about it? There is no such doubly charged negative particle. And then again, in comes the freely inventing of things. We invent a new particle that must save the situation. I invent a new particle, a neutral one, which I will call the Z0. And that I will give the couplings as shown in the lower diagram. I will couple it to the W's. And I will couple it also to the electron and the neutrino, or the electron. So I'm creating a new particle, which is called the Z0. I get a new type of diagram here, the Z0. And it will couple, for example, to an electron. Yeah. That's that thing that you see down below. And it will also couple, to name something else, I will also have, pardon, excuse me. Maybe I should. I thought it would be a dramatic thing to draw these figures where we are going on, and you see it becomes a mess. You should really first try those things before you do them. Well, you know, what do I want to do? Here's the Z0. I ask for your forgiveness. And I will be gone before you can regret it. So here you see two new elements that I've introduced and that I can use as building blocks for yet other possibilities coming up. We have the Z0 coupling to the electron here. We have the Z0 coupling to the vector bosons. New particle has come in the game here. And now that's all very well. But now comes the crucial question. Is it there? First of all, do I know exactly what I must have? And indeed, I know precisely what I must have. This particle must act there in such a way that this process cancels whatever goes on, in the top one here. Because it must damp out this bad high energy behavior that I cannot live with. So I know very precisely what I should allow here. And that means that I can find out from that how this Z0 couples to the electron and the positron, or to the E plus here, the electron here, and the W's. So by this story here, which now, this was the thing that I was trying to do in the 70s. Yeah, this was the problem. The problem was you had reactions like this, and you started thinking about it. It was, of course, point number one. If you didn't start thinking about it, you never invent anything. But so you start thinking about this, and then you discover, after a lot of time spent in a parking lot, you find that you can do it by introducing one new particle. And then you fiddle and you tune and this and that, where you're going. So that's the Z0, and of course here comes the, this is really what I'm trying to tell you here is a game that I'll give you some indication. I don't know, my time I guess must be more or less over. We are playing a game here. I have a set of particles, I scatter them off each other, and I insist that whatever I scatter them off gives life rise to a process that behaves in a certain decent manner as a function of energy. And I have to try everybody with everybody. And in the process, you have to introduce all kinds of particles to make this cure, that cure. It gets a total mess. And that game of finding these particles, collaborating everybody such that all cross-sections behave constant, that generates what we now call a gauge theory. It has a large degree of symmetry. It says, if you have this, you must have that. If you have that top thing there, you must have the Z0. Yeah? And the next question then is this game that we are playing, and of which we might ask whether nature is following us, is it true? Mind you, in 1970, when we were doing this, we didn't even know that the vector bosons existed. And so now you play a game which is putting speculation on top of speculation. But the fact is, without playing this game, we never knew how to make something decent from these original neutrino interactions. We started introducing the vector boson to make that first reaction decent, and then we started considering considering reactions just like that out of the top of our head with those vector bosons, and we found we had to introduce other things. And it's interesting if nature goes along to play this game. And this is, of course, the ultimate thing, and nature did. In 1974, it was found in that Gargamel bubble chamber that I've shown you in the beginning, there were found reactions that showed that there was a Z0. I'm not going to explain them in detail because I don't have any time to do that. But that, in 1974, I would say, was the starting point of the victory of gauge series. Series of this type in which you got lots of particles that had to collaborate in certain ways, had to keep a delicate balance. Really, I mean, if you do anything whatsoever, the whole series explodes. So a very delicate balance, and nature is dancing to that tune. So the Z0 was found. And after that, many others were found. The top quark is one of the things that you may have heard in the last few days. I'll tell you finally what happened to the Z0 and consider that a point where I will more or less stop. And you can go into this to any detail you want. So these are the new basic things that I built for you. This was the type of experiment they did at CERN. They had a neutrino exchange the Z0 onto an electron. It's called a neutral current event if you go into the literature. And then finally, in 1982, the Z0 itself was discovered. And how did they discover that? And that's an interesting thing. So I will sort of close with that, if I can find all these pens again. I have no idea. Oh, here. So you realize from the existence of this one here that this one must also be a possible process. Excuse me, you start with from this process. I bent one of these electrons back, so I get this process, and I make a Z0. And you have learned enough already to know that this will be an electron, and this will be an electron but with positive charge, because combined they must make something zero of neutral charge, Z0. And this has actually been done by accelerating electrons, by accelerating positively charged electrons. I'm not talking about how you get them, but to have the antiparticles also in the ring, but in the same ring, but in the opposite direction, and then have them collide at certain points. You can steer that. And the big machine you are seeing there on the first slide, yeah, was the machine that actually, where this is actually happening. Because that Z0 is so heavy, you need an immense energy, and you needed this energy, this machine, which has this circumference of about 17 miles, in order to get electrons and positrons to that energy that together they can make that Z0. But it was actually produced. I don't know the exact date. It must have been somewhere at the end of the 80s. Yeah, that Z0 was made, was observed by detection instruments, by people such as Baron Rowe here. And then the thing was literally there. And not only that one, but also others were seen. But I want to, that's where I more or less want to terminate. Let's see what for other slides that I still have up there. And can we go one further just for the hell of it, or maybe it's the end? One more. Is there no more slide? Or sad life is no more. Can you go back to the very beginning, the first slide? So we started off here in 61, and finally, by this sinking process I was giving to you, we arrived at the Z0, and this was the machine that was... I can tell you a bit more of the history of that machine so that you see that this is not just something. That gauge theory, that playing with particles and everything, was a game that we played in 1970. And it became commonplace quite quickly. So by about 75, I think you could see that you would be able to make a Z0 with this kind of a thing. And the theory was already that good at the time. You could make a guess as to how heavy the Z0 would be, so how much energy you would need to make it. So starting 75, 3-4 years after the mathematical discoveries I'm trying to tell you, we knew that this was a machine to look at. So don't think too much as something mathematics here. There's really a lot of physics going on. I think the Swedes have hit too much on the mathematical piece. That's because on a previous occasion they had given away the Nobel Prize to some other people for some physics that they don't want to mention at this time. So there's a bit of that in it, and for this it gets a bit represented in a somewhat twisted way. So here's that big ring, and that really was something we knew. I knew, many of those who were in the business with me knew it by 75. And at that time I was sitting in a committee in Geneva that was directing where CERN would go in the future, and I started from that point onwards pushing for this machine. And I think by 1980 the whole community was convinced and pushed to get this machine, and it was decided to build it in 1980. And it came ready somewhere around 1990 or a bit earlier even. When did it come ready, Byron, do you remember? Huh? 89. And there was what they call LEP functioning. And that machine has established this way of thinking and calculating to a degree of a precision, which is very, very, very high. What will be the future of this business? Well, if you keep on playing the game that I'm telling you, there is one particle, everybody was found except there is one, called a Higgs particle, just try to remember that name, which in the whole affair plays a role that I'm saying here. It is there to damp off certain reactions in an appropriate manner. But it is sort of the job it has to do is just killing off some remnant. So it's a particle whose work is sort of light in the context of this whole affair. It's not so strong. It's somewhere in the background, and you're not, in fact, you start feeling uneasy, you're not really sure whether you need it or not, or what is it. And there is another thing about that particle, is that it has bad side effects. And the side effects are that this particle does something with gravitation which is enormously bothersome. What it does, it creates an energy in the vacuum all around the universe. And now that there is an energy around in the universe doesn't bother you so much because, you know, there it is and how do you see it. But the fact is gravitation worries about that. And Einstein has explained to us that if you have a lot of energy around, the space gets curved. Now, if you look tomorrow to the football game, remember that the Higgs particle would curve the universe to something the size of a football. This, I think, is not true. And now, so what do you do? The real theorist does not shrink away from this possibility. So the real theorist does this. He first bends the universe in the other way. Then on comes this Higgs. And it's done in such a way that in the end you have something flat. Now the amount of compensation that you have to do is something that you could envisage like this. Initially this ball is standing there in the middle of the game. You remember that starts there, yeah? And then they start playing. Now imagine after all the playing, when the final whistle is blown, the ball ends in the same position to a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a millimeter. That doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, that something like that would happen. And that's what's sort of going on. And we don't understand it, and we are scared of it on one side, but on the other side, utterly curious, because now happens here something that is really new. Through our world of elementary particles, we sneak in, and there we come onto gravitation. And gravitation is, in today's physics, still a very mysterious thing. We don't know much about it. The astronomers say they know a lot about it, but they're just lying. I also tell you why I'm saying this. I'm distinguishing different branches of science by their degree of hardness. And of course, astronomers and economists and all that kind of people. No, I don't want to say any bad about the people. It's the profession that we are talking about. They have to work with something that they cannot experiment with. All they can do is wait what happens and see. Yeah. So economy, it's very hard to figure out the laws of economics. And in the end, you see it happening. And the economists are sort of running behind the facts. And they try to tune their theories to be in accordance with the facts. But in the sense of predictive power, those theories aren't really that good. Yeah. And with astronomy, it's the same. They just have to wait whatever the stars wish to send us, to us in the way of particles or light or whatever. But it would be so nice if we could actually, for example, create a black hole by shooting two stars together, but you cannot. So if you get to see an astronomer, listen for the following keywords. He will say, at some point, he will describe to you a situation which is so complex that no one has the foggiest notion what's going on. And then he will say, we cannot explain this unless we assume the existence of a black hole. Now, if we had done things that way in elementary particle physics, I wouldn't be going to Sweden in December, I can tell you that. So let's leave it at that, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you something. I've had a dream when I was young. There was a movie by Charlie Chaplin called The Great Dictator. Yeah. In this, Charlie Chaplin plays Adolf Hitler and makes a joke of it. But it was a very beautiful scene. The Führer gave a speech, yeah, and he would halt, and everyone knew that you had to applaud and shout Sieg Heil. And then he did, and they would stop like that. Yeah. So next time, when you applaud or something like that, when I do this, you stop, right?
Thank you very much, Professor Weltmann, for a marvelous introduction to the mysterious world of particle physics. And I'm sure Professor Weltmann would be happy to take some of the questions from the audience. Please.
We simply use the arrow to say which is the positron. So the arrow denotes the direction of electric charge. This way it's negative, that way it's positive. Yeah. Yes?
Does the W particle have mass?
Which one?
Does the W particle have mass?
Which particle?
W.
W, oh, bloody heavy. It's let me see, the W is 80 GeV, the proton is about 1 GeV, to give you the measure, standard. Yeah? And the W is 80 GeV, and the Z0 is 90 GeV. Really very heavy. And the top quark is 175. That's the heaviest one we know today. And we suspect that the Higgs, well, if it was less than about 100 GeV, I think we would have seen it. And we haven't seen it so far. And theoretically, we know we are getting in sort of trouble when it exceeds like 300 GeV, but we will not get it until the next machine, of which you have seen some pictures, but I didn't tell you what it was, which is in the lab tunnel, in that big tunnel where we have that electron machine. Or they're busy building another machine in which they will use protons and go to much higher energy. I believe something like 15 TeV, is that not the number, Byron? I forget all these numbers. So it will be like this lab machine goes to about 200 GeV, 200 times. This one will go to 170 times. No, 200 versus 17,000. Okay, so it's a lot higher. That machine will be switched on, hopefully, in 2005 in Geneva. The Americans have decided not to do anything by discontinuing the SSC in Texas, which is really a pity. So we have to do with that machine in Europe, and we have to do with the fact that it's bound by that tunnel that we have. But perhaps we will get that Higgs particle and finally get a clue as to what gravitation is all about. And this I find a very exciting part of elementary particle physics. And I don't know what it will do to our understanding of the universe. But I'm looking very much forward to something moving there.
Chamber which you show in the beginning was invented in this department.
Yes. What Professor Tomozawa is referring to is that here in Michigan, I find Michigan University modest to a degree which I don't think is realistic. They all only talk about professor being so-called faculty members. In a sense, I'm gone, you know. They count anyway, they have a counting method. But Mr. Glaser did his invention while drinking beer somewhere in the brown jug or something. Yeah. And he invented the bubble chamber. This is recorded in a book by Leon Lederman called The God Particle. So if you want to know more details, you can read it in that book. And after he invented the bubble chamber, he moved somewhere else. Well, we move all the time. I've been at CERN, Utrecht, Michigan. All of us have become an international brand of people. Yeah. And so I would say that to me the important thing is that Mr. Glaser could do his invention here, and the university was providing all the facilities and the possibilities for doing so, and if you're smart enough and inventive enough, you can do something. That's the important thing. For all I care, they may take Mr. Glaser's contribution as something part of this university. Yeah. So that's what Yukio said. Yes. The positron, what?
The positron.
Well, they can combine again and become a gamma again. So this is a possible process. I'll use only one color pen because else you get. Here it goes in two and then it recombines. So you get things like that. And many more things of that type. And to tell you what goes on here gets a little bit more complicated, but can be done. This happens. You can detect that this happens, actually. There are ways of getting at it.
We know, as you said, that there are photons and neutrinos and such racing all around all the time.
We've seen them,
These heavier particles like the vector bosons and Z0s, do they actually get created in multiple
They only appear if you have more energy than needed to generate 90 GeV of mass. So you must have a machine that accelerates particles to at least that energy. There aren't that many machines of that type. Yeah. But once you have that, you create them. Now, the other thing is, just because they are so heavy, there's a lot of energy there, and they decay very, very quickly. So these vector bosons and Z0s decay in such a short time, you can't see that. You can certainly not do beams with them or anything like it. Yeah. But there are other methods for getting onto it. And many methods, but I would need much more time to explain that. Yeah. Yes? We all are.
How many particles are there as far as what you call it?
Well, I'll give you the picture, okay?
Yeah.
And I'll give you a piece of wonderment here, yes?
The second question I have is, do you have a feel if we're approaching some sort of top limit of the number of particles, or are we going to continue looking, or are we kind of at the beginning, or do you feel like we're...
I'll tell you, if I give me the time. May I have about 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. So I tell you what our... more or less the particles that we know today. And you will see something that will astonish you no end. What we have can be grouped in the following way. Here is the neutrino, here is the electron, then there are the quarks that you will find in the proton. We call them the up and the down quark. And there's two such quarks, and we know also they come in three varieties. All of which I cannot go into detail, but these are the particles that we know, and of which the proton is made, and a neutron here, the electron and the neutrino. But then, lo and behold, we found another neutrino. Neutrino, let's say I give it an index mu. We found another thing like the electron, except 200 times heavier. We found another quark, which since we didn't know what it was, we called it a strange quark. And then we found another quark going in the same vein. This was called the charm quark, and also these came in three varieties. And our cup was flowing over because then, someday, someone found yet another particle, the tau. It's yet like 900 times, 1800 times, 18 times heavier than the muon. It's really very funny. And then we found yet another quark called the bottom quark, and yet another quark now, which is called the top quark. Now, this you see here something which is stunning. Three identical things, and what for? Now, if, like me, you had been sitting behind your desk in 1976, roughly seeing this picture coming up, there were still some holes, the top wasn't there, but I could see this picture filling up, what would you think? Now, I have learned long ago that the nature goes like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, etc. Yeah? So if you were three of them, for sure there must be 100 of them. That would be the logical sort. So the first question I start posing myself is, do we have any hold? Can we make any guess as how many times this is going on? And this we have found methods. And I can't go into them, but you can find them by the sort of reasoning I've been doing, by looking to certain processes. You can actually see the effects of those particles. You can make a guess what it is. And I can tell you that we now know with quite some certainty that this is it. Now, this is something. And the something that it is the following. If I have something that goes on indefinitely, like the nuclei, for example, you start with element 1, which is hydrogen, you wind up with 92. You can make more, which they do at Lawrence Radiation Lab. They create einsteinium and what have you, all these others. And you can sort of go on without end. And that's what you have when you have a bound state from a number of basic building blocks. You add some more, you go to the next one. You know, you can always add more. If these things, this repetition, which at first glance you would assume to be evidence for building blocks one step down, and that now you have seen three of them and then four, etc., you may not understand all the details, but you think this is evidence for a substructure. But the fact that it stops at three forbids you to think so. You cannot do it. I've been trying very hard, you may remember in the older days, in trying to make a model that would create such a recurrence of three, but then you get four, five, you can do it. Yeah. So we look at a repetition here, which is three, which is not a bound state, and what is it? This here, I consider the great puzzle of our times. We have to understand someday why there are three generations. And they are wildly crazy. The craziness of this becomes evident if I tell you the mass of these particles. The electron has a mass of half an MeV. I'll do it in some measure, which is 1,000th of the GeV we are speaking about. The muon has 100 MeV. The tau is, I believe, 1,750 or something. Yeah? Well, already it's hard to understand why you have this enormous difference in the weight of these particles, but it gets even crazier here. The up and the down quark are of the order of 5 MeV. And then the strange quark is something like 250, and the charm quark is something like 1,500. But then the top quark finally is 175,000. Yeah. What kind of a thing is this? What's going on here? No one knows. No clue. They make big series, so big you can fill up books, but if you think they tell me what's going on, no. Yeah. So this I consider truly the big problem posed to us by nature today. And no one has a clue how to get at it. And if you have an idea, well, here's the road to Sweden. Yeah.
Thank you very much, and I understand President Bollinger will have some closing remarks.
Just very briefly, I want to say again to Professor Veltman how grateful we are for sharing in the excitement of this moment. We know that more than anything, because you said this last night, that you are desirous of returning back to your home, closing the door, and staying alone for a week or 2 weeks, as you were at the time when you first started on this course that led you to the present point. But still, you still have a reception to attend and to appear to flip the coin at tomorrow's football game. He's forbidden from actually flipping it, but from the stands, you won't be able to tell. Again, thank you very much, and let me just issue a standing invitation to you and to Annika to return to Ann Arbor anytime you wish. Congratulations, and thank you.